I hope nobody in here has the same reaction. But okay, we're introducing ourselves tonight to the book of Ezekiel, and your assignment was to start reading through the book, maybe get through the first 10 chapters or so. I hope everybody had a chance to do that. And your impression, having gone through those first 10 chapters, is, Ralph, what? Ralph laughs and says, confusing. Okay, does everybody share that reaction? Okay, can you see why a lot of people then say, okay, I think I'll just close the book of Ezekiel and we'll just go over to Matthew chapter 1. Okay. We don't want to do that. This is what happens to folks. And like we said last time, there are just three things you've got to get down to make these Old Testament prophets just come alive and become very understandable. We've got to understand the nature of the prophet's work. That's what we talked about in our last class. You've got to understand the historical setting, and you've got to understand the ancient culture in order to appreciate the things that they're saying and why they are saying it. And so we're going to be talking this evening about the historical setting, and a lot of you tell me that you love the history. There are some of you who tell me, especially the one I'm married to, that you can't stand when I go, I'll go over all the history, you know, the history again. Okay, but if you will just get in your mind the basic historical events that we're going to talk about tonight, the book of Ezekiel will just come alive. Okay? I promise you. And that's really the way it is with all of the Old Testament prophets. If you just understand the historical setting and certain events around which their oracles are based, then everything makes sense. And so that's what we want to do, is to help us really appreciate the book of Ezekiel. It really is just rich. And my goal is, by the end of our study, for you to then say to me, without me having to bribe you to say it, that really was good, that really helped me, and now I understand what the book of Ezekiel is all about. So that's our goal, and I think we really will be benefited from it. Okay. Old Testament history, just kind of get in your mind the basic history. The whole concept of the Israelites coming out of Egypt, the law of Moses being given to them, we're all, I think, well acquainted with that. We all are well acquainted with the era of the judges and the United Monarchy period and all of that. Keep in mind that, as we've talked about previously, Moses had said that they would have prophets in Israel. And certainly when Samuel comes along, what you see is this band of the prophets that begins to emerge. I'm not saying there weren't prophets prior to Samuel, but especially during the time of Samuel, you've got this band of prophets, and these prophets are giving their prophetic oracles to the nation, trying to get the people to repent. You have the divided monarchy period, and as you know, during that division, the people are divided up into these two nations. The northern kingdom, completely rebellious against the Lord. Southern kingdom, somewhat obedient, but mostly rebellious throughout their years. Now, here's the point that we really need to focus our attention on. The midpoint of the divided monarchy period. The midpoint of the divided monarchy period. That's when God has his prophets start doing something that they had not been doing before. That they hadn't been doing, say, when Elijah was a prophet or when Elisha was a prophet. What starts to happen in the latter period of the divided monarchy period? Anybody know? God has the prophets give oracles that he then has them write down and preserve for future generations. And these are these prophets that start coming on the scene, whom we know from the Old Testament books by their names. Prophets like Amos and Hosea and Jonah, who were prophesying to the northern kingdom of Israel. And then also, again, in the latter portion of that divided monarchy period, down south for the southern kingdom of Judah, prophets like Isaiah and Micah and Zephaniah and Nahum and Habakkuk. And they are now giving oracles And the oracles are being preserved in written form, and that's what these books of prophecy are. And why are these oracles that are given now, starting at this point in Old Testament history, why are these oracles being preserved in written form? What's true about these oracles, Jared?
I don't know what you're really talking about. Really, it's writing them down because they know the fall of Jerusalem is going to occur.
Exactly. Because in the latter half of the divided monarchy period, it has now reached the point where exile into a foreign nation, like God had said back in Moses' day, that's virtually inevitable. The nation is so corrupt, they are so disobedient to God's law, they don't care about God's law. They want to do what they want to do, and they want religion to be fun and enjoyable like they want it to be, and so they don't care about God's law, and as a result of that, they have gotten so corrupt and they're so hardened that exile is inevitable. And so now you've got oracles that are being written down because these oracles are talking about exile is inevitable. Can you see why those would need to be written down? Not for the benefit of those who are going into exile, but for whose benefit? Okay, those who would be living at the time, say, of the exile or beyond, that they would then understand, here's why this happened to our nation. And this is not something that was happenstance, but God foretold this, and this is exactly why it has happened. And so this is one reason why these oracles now are being written down, oracles that are prophesying about the impending doom when foreign armies will take them into exile. Also, these prophetic oracles that are being written down, they're not just messages of doom, but they're also messages of what? Hope that would come about before the exile? No. Exile's going to happen. Judgment's coming. But hope afterward. After judgment has taken place, is there a hope for God's people after that? And yes, the prophets were saying that's exactly what the case is. And so these oracles are being written down, once again, not for the benefit so much of the contemporaries of these prophets, but really for those who would come after them, who would be able to see the events that transpire, be able to see that this is what God said would happen, and also would be able to see God also had those very same prophets preach a message of hope after judgment. So that's what's going on now. So I want us to see the big picture of these Old Testament prophets and the oracles that are being written down. Okay, we need to put Ezekiel in that context of the other writing prophets. By the way, before I move on to Ezekiel and his contemporaries, right about the time of the Babylonian exile, this same band of prophets, they also write down not just the oracles, but what do they write? What other Old Testament book? The books of Samuel and Kings. You see, it's at this point in Old Testament history when Samuel and Kings are written. They're written at the end of the divided monarchy period when the exile is happening. Okay? Samuel may have been written a little bit earlier, but certainly Kings is written when the exile has already begun. And so what's the point of these histories, Samuel and Kings, that the prophets are writing? What's the point of that? It's explaining what? What, John? Okay, this is how we got to the place where we're at now, where we're in exile in a foreign country, and we're not in the land flowing with milk and honey. Exactly. And that's what God wanted done here, is that the history of a nation to be written down so that those coming after could learn from that. So here's what these writing prophets are doing. They're writing down the oracles, and they're writing down the history of the nation that ultimately culminated in exile, just like God promised it would. And so that's what these prophets are doing. Okay, that kind of gives us an overall background to now focus our attention specifically at the time of the exile. Who is the major prophet at the time of the exile, the Babylonian exile, that generation? Who's the major prophet?
Jeremiah.
Okay? In every generation, God had a major prophet. He had other prophets, but there was always a major figure. He's kind of the leader of that prophetic band. Without question, during the years prior to the Babylonian exile, and then during the years, at least the early years of the Babylonian exile, Jeremiah is the major prophet, okay? And then also a prophet during the time of the exile is... All right, Ezekiel, forget him, shame on you. Ezekiel will be the major prophet, not for the people who are left behind in Judah, but the prophet for those who have been exiled to Babylonia. Okay? And then also, during the time of the exile, who's another prophet that we all think of? All right, Daniel. Okay, just so you kind of get that full picture in mind. So make sure in your mind you're recognizing Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel, all prophets here during the time of the Babylonian exile. Without question, though, Jeremiah and Ezekiel, they are the major prophetic figures here during this period. All right, any question or comment up to this point? All right. Let's just make sure we understand the big historical picture. For the previous two centuries, the major power of the ancient world has been Assyria. 200 plus years, Assyria has been the major power. It has dominated not only Mesopotamia, where its chief territory is located. You see Assyria up there in the northern part of Mesopotamia. But also its power and... hegemony has been exercised across the Euphrates River on into the other side of the Fertile Crescent, down to that Levant region, all the way virtually to the border of Egypt. That's the Assyrian Empire. And, of course, that encompasses Palestine, the Promised Land. So for two centuries, okay, for the 9th and 8th centuries B.C., Assyria has been the major power, okay? But in the... In fact, who's the king of Judah? Who's the major reforming king of Judah in the latter part of the 8th century B.C.? After Hezekiah. Josiah, okay? Josiah is the major reforming king of Judah during the final days of Assyrian domination. And the nation that would rise up, a little bit of help from the Medes, but the nation that would rise up and would ultimately defeat Assyria is going to be Babylonia, okay? And Babylonia is led by Nabopolassar, and his son, whom we know, Nebuchadnezzar. Absolutely major figures on world history. Not just biblical history, but world history. And so Babylonia is rising up in power, in military might, during the reign of Josiah, say 740 B.C., on down further. In fact, I just remembered I meant to pass out these sheets. Let me just real quickly. Eric, would you mind you and Justin? Thank you. Everyone have a copy of both of those. So I want you to just kind of get this picture in mind. In 609 B.C., Nineveh, the capital city of Assyria, falls to Babylonian armies. 609, okay? Now, think about this from the perspective of Judah. Josiah has been reigning in Judah for several years. And he has been serving Yahweh and trying to turn the nation back to Yahweh. Assyria is on the decline. Babylonia is on the rise. And Babylonia defeats the Assyrians and conquers Nineveh, the capital city of the Assyrian Empire, in 609 B.C. That's absolutely huge. All right. Now, in, I said, 612 B.C. Pardon. Did I say 609? 612 B.C. is when Nineveh falls. Good. I'm glad you were. I'm glad. I hope nobody just sit there like a stump, you know, and not say anything. That's right. 612. Pardon me. Then in 609 B.C., Kyle, what happened?
I don't get it wrong.
Thought maybe you'd gotten the sheet yet. You sat on that side of the room, so you haven't gotten the sheet yet. In 609 B.C., Pharaoh Necho of Egypt takes his army up through Palestine en route to do battle with the Babylonians, joining forces with the Assyrians. Pharaoh Necho of Egypt wants to help Assyria defeat the Babylonians. In 609 B.C. at Megiddo, Josiah, that great reforming king of Judah, does something really foolish. What does he do? Tries to cut off Pharaoh Necho at the pass, so to speak, and prevent him from joining forces with Assyria so that Babylonia would fall. And Josiah thought that was going to be a good move. The book of Kings does not say God told him to do this. He did this on his own, apparently. He thought it was a wise move. It turned out to be tremendously foolish. And Pharaoh Necho has occasion to come upon Josiah, and he kills him. So just think about this, about what's happening now. Josiah in 609 at Megiddo, he loses in this makeshift battle, and he gets killed. What's that do to the southern kingdom of Judah then? Josiah was there. One bright star, keeping the nation in line with Yahweh's will. And now Josiah is dead. And so this kind of marks the beginning of the end. Josiah's death in 609 is the beginning of the end. And I've kind of likened it in the past to kind of like when your bathtub is draining and you do the plug and at first you don't really see the water moving very much, but as more and more water drains out, as it gets toward the very end, what happens to the water? It's just going fast and furious. That's what happens historically. Because once Josiah dies, now the end is inevitable and all sorts of things start happening. In 605 B.C., this is another major date that you need to appreciate. 605 B.C. at the Battle of Carchemish, that's when the Egyptians and the Assyrians, who have joined forces to fight against Nebuchadnezzar of Babylonia, that's when the Egyptians and the Assyrians are defeated by Nebuchadnezzar. And so now Babylonia has not only defeated the eastern portion of the Assyrian Empire, like they did when they conquered Nineveh, but now even the western portion of the empire of Assyria, they have conquered. Okay? Huh? I don't have any others. Okay. So all that takes place in 605, and so that marks the end. Those two dates, 612 and then 605, mark the end of the Assyrian Empire. Okay? Question about that? All right, now let's move quickly to the key events that relate to Ezekiel. And if you'll just know these events, the book of Ezekiel will make total sense. 605, Battle of Carchemish. Nebuchadnezzar of Babylonia has defeated Assyria now. The Babylonians are in charge of the world, basically. And so what does Nebuchadnezzar do? He comes to Jerusalem and he deposes the current king at the time who Pharaoh Necho had put on the throne, Jehoiachin, the son of, son of Josiah. He deposes Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah. Jehoiakim is put on the throne. In 605 B.C., you've got the first deportation of Jews, a small number of Jews who are taken away into Babylon exile. Who's in that mix? All right, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, okay? Okay, that incident is never mentioned in Ezekiel. Okay, in fact, it's only mentioned in the book of Daniel. Very minor deportation. But we usually kind of think of that as the beginning of the Babylonian exile period. Okay, then, major date, 597 B.C. This is when Nebuchadnezzar's armies come back to Palestine, and this is when Jerusalem is now captured. And the current king on the throne is Jehoiachin, the son of Jehoiakim. He's been reigning all of 3 months. How's that? You're reigning your king for 3 months, and now your kingdom is captured by the Babylonians, and he's taken away into exile. Okay? So 597 B.C., Jerusalem is captured. You've got the second deportation of Jews into Babylonian exile. This is a massive number of the upper crust of society. And also in that upper crust, not just nobles, but business people, important people, skilled craftsmen, all those people, in addition to all those people, who is taken in the second deportation to Babylon? Ezekiel. Okay? So this is when Ezekiel is taken away into exile. All right? Same time Jehoiachin, the king, is taken away into exile. Okay? The new king that Nebuchadnezzar puts on the throne is another son, a third son of Josiah, Zedekiah. And Zedekiah ultimately rebels against Nebuchadnezzar, doesn't want to pay tribute, thinks maybe Egypt might be able to help defeat the Babylonians, doesn't listen to Jeremiah the prophet, and so Zedekiah finally rebels, and in 586 B.C., that's when Jerusalem is destroyed. Okay, the siege begins a couple of years earlier, but the city finally falls in 586 B.C. You've got the third deportation of Jews into Babylonian exile. That's when now the temple of Yahweh is destroyed, burned. The temple of Solomon symbolized the whole Davidic throne. It's destroyed, burned to the ground. And so 586, this marks now the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Now, I want to ask you, let me make this observation. Most of Ezekiel is taking place in between these two dates. Okay? In between the second deportation and the third. In between the time when Jerusalem was captured in 597 and when it's finally destroyed in 586 B.C. The first 24 chapters of Ezekiel are all oracles and all things that are going on during those years. Okay? So if you want to kind of visualize this, these are the two dates during which the book of Ezekiel is taking place. Okay? Tom? Okay, when the text says the first dating that is given, he says in the 30th year, and then also gives another date, in the fifth year of Jehoiachin. So that's one of the interpretation questions. I think most people think when he says the 30th year, he's talking about the 30th year of Ezekiel's life, meaning he was 30 years of age. That seems to be what the text is saying. Okay? And we'll talk a little bit more about that after a bit. So, this does kind of tie in with what Tommy was just saying, because what Tommy is talking about in the very first part of the book starts out with the call of Ezekiel, and this takes place in 593 BC. Now, he was taken away into exile in 597, but the fifth year is 593, and that's when the Lord calls him to be a prophet. And so what I want you to see, folks, is that the majority of Ezekiel's oracles, the first part of the book, first half, all those events are taking place in between 593 BC and the time when Jerusalem is destroyed in 586. Now let me ask you this. All those writing prophets, since the mid part of the divided monarchy, they've been warning about judgment, warning about wrath to come. Okay, finally, when Jerusalem is captured in 597 BC, what would you expect? What finally is now the response of the people when Jerusalem is finally captured now, like the prophets warned in 597? Did it have an impact upon their hearts? Some of you are nodding yes. And guess what? No, it didn't. Not now. Not yet. Okay? Now, once the exile had been totally finished, then did it have an impact upon the hearts of the people? Yes. But this is what a lot of folks don't realize. I think some people kind of think that, okay, the prophets have been warning about this. Well, then finally when Jerusalem is captured, okay, then everybody said, Jeremiah, you're a true prophet. You were right. Praise Yahweh, we will serve him now. That's not what happened. No. The reaction of people was, okay, yes, we have had a large number of our people who have been taken captive into a foreign land. They're prisoners in a foreign land. But the people were thinking, our God will do what for us? He will save us and bring them back. Remember when Lot was captured by the Mesopotamian kings? Abraham goes out to fight against those five kings, you know, defeats them, Abraham and his little army. But Yahweh was with him, and he brings Lot back and all the spoils of war. This is what the people were thinking. Our God, Yahweh, He isn't going to allow us to just languish in exile or something. And he's not going to allow his sanctuary to be destroyed where his name is. He's not going to allow the throne of David to be cast to the ground. And so here's what I want us to see. During these years, what is the job of prophets like Ezekiel and like Jeremiah back in Judah? What are they trying to do? They have one task: to get the people to understand this is judgment. There's no mercy now. Now's the time of judgment. It's kind of like when parents, you know, they warn their child, you know, I'm going to give you a whipping if you keep doing it. I'm going to give you a whipping. Of course, we've got a lot of parents in our day who then never back up what they say. That's probably one reason why the kids act this way. But then, okay, finally, when it comes time, then the reaction of the kid is either, well, oh, he won't carry through with that. Now I can cry, and now I can be remorseful, and he'll have compassion. Or, if that's not the case, the kid gets angry and gets more rebellious. Guess what happened here? That's exactly what's going on. God's not, oh, okay, we get the message. We're going to serve him, you know, and haven't we been serving him? Well, maybe it hadn't been as good as we should, but okay. So he isn't going to allow us to continue to be judged. They're all going to come back soon. And that's what the people are saying. And Ezekiel is saying all during these years, in fact, what we'll see is that his oracles from 593 to 586, they all have to do with Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. Yahweh is not going to show any mercy whatsoever. That will happen. And the people don't believe it. They just don't. It's incredible. But yet this is what human beings do. And this is how we act so often. We really don't believe that God's going to do. Now, he said he would, but he's loving, he's compassionate, he hadn't before. We can, you know, and we come up with all sorts of rationalizations. We haven't been all that bad. That's exactly what we will see. The people are going to rationalize everything. We aren't that sinful. The other people are a lot worse than we are. You know, all sorts of reasons. And that's what Ezekiel is going to be dealing with, a people. The judgment process has already begun, and they still don't want to believe. I talked last class about some of the odd things that prophets would do to try to get the people's attention in their stupor, just to kind of arrest their attention. Odd things the prophets would do. Of all the Old Testament prophets, who's the prophet who does more odd things than any other prophet? Ezekiel. This is why. Because these people just do, even the ones who are in exile, they don't, we're going to be going home soon. And what does Ezekiel keep saying to them? No, you're not. So this is the background of the book. This is the historical setting of it. Okay? All right, Isaac?
The fact that judgment had come and this was a done deal, you know, my mind goes to some of the verses I think of in Jeremiah where God constantly, that I seem to think, constantly said to his people, if you turn around, I want to do this. Am I seeing that correctly? Was God saying to these people, hey,
prior? At this point, what we will see, and this is the whole point of Ezekiel's prophetic word, at this point, nothing's going to change this. Nothing.
Was it the case of God knowing they wouldn't repent?
Well, I think that's the case. But the way it's presented, it's too late now. There's nothing. And of course, the attitude of the people, when they hear that, you know, like I said, like the kid who's, you know, now he is going to get the whipping. Well, now he's angry at the parent. How dare you? You know, I mean, so that's how they reacted. You know, so yes, we're at the point now. In fact, this is why Ezekiel so often will make the point: God will show no mercy, because now, you know, once judgment is here, okay, the time for mercy is past, and so now. This is it. So, okay, other comments, questions? All right. Now, what we also need to appreciate is there is another background figure here. Not because he's a player in all this, but he's constantly referred to. And that's King Jehoiachin. In fact, what's interesting is that Ezekiel's oracles, nearly all of them are dated very specifically. In fact, most of them are in chronological sequence. And they are dated in accordance with King Jehoiachin's reign. And keep in mind that Jehoiachin's first year of reigning was, he got to go into exile. So, you know. So his reign is as a deposed king. But he's regarded as the king on the books. Remember, he was replaced by his brother Zedekiah. But Jehoiachin is the titular king. He's the legal king as far as the books are concerned. And so he's in exile, But the whole point of this is that here is the Davidic king, and he's in exile, and he's going to stay in exile. In fact, I'll just say this. What did Jeremiah say about the heritage of Jehoiachin? He would be judged and he would be written childless, meaning he wasn't going to have an heir that would assume the throne, because this is what God's doing to the house of Jerusalem and the house of David. But I want you to see that all during Ezekiel's time of prophesying, just keep this mental picture that here is Jehoiachin. Well, he's an imprisoned king. Okay? And, of course, there's symbolic impact in all of that. Okay? I mean, let me just show you one thing. It's interesting when you look at what the book of Kings say, or Chronicles, excuse me, Jeremiah says about Jehoiachin. In Jeremiah 52, he did note this, that after Nebuchadnezzar died and was succeeded by Evil-Merodach, here's what happened. In the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiachin, king of Judah, that Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, in the first year of his reign, showed favor to Jehoiachin, king of Judah, and brought him out of prison. So Jehoiachin changed his prison clothes and had his meals in the king's presence regularly all the days of his life. That is, from that point on. For his allowance, a regular allowance was given him by the king of Babylon, a daily portion all the days of his life until the day of his death. So does everyone see what happened? Nebuchadnezzar's the one who imprisoned and exiled Jehoiachin, but the successor of Nebuchadnezzar, Evil-Merodach, he has a different attitude about him. He's still captive. He still isn't functioning as a reigning king. But he allows him to sit at the king's table and receive the king's rations. Okay. So there's that little bit of compassion that is showed. A couple of reasons why I point that out to you. One is that here is the Babylonian record that archaeologists discovered that gives the rations of the king's table. And guess what? It mentions Jehoiachin and the rations that were given him, just like Jeremiah said. Except this is the Babylonian account of that, but it's the Babylonian account of what Jeremiah was talking about. So I think that's interesting. I always like to show you things that corroborate the Old Testament history. But the other reason why I think that is an important thing to keep in mind, when we get to the second half of Ezekiel, in other words, after the destruction of Jerusalem of 586 has occurred, guess what happens to Ezekiel's oracles then? Well, then he starts talking about hope, about restoration, about ultimate reestablishment of the Davidic monarchy. Not by a descendant of Jehoiachin, you know, it would be in the distant future, but there is hope. And so you're starting to see some of those signs of hope that kind of transpire historically. Okay. Question or comment up to this point? All right. If everybody will just look, you can look at the sheet that the guys handed out to you. Here's a basic outline of the book of Ezekiel. Now, I have divided this up into 6 major sections, but let me show you this. From chapter 1, that first major section, all the way down here to the fourth major section, chapter 24, verse 27, in other words, the end of chapter 24, chapters 1 through 24, all of that really has to do with the impending judgment of Jerusalem. It is going to happen. God's not going to recant. So That's what I mean when I say, you know, the first 24 chapters, it's all about that. Okay, then you've got the judgment of foreign nations. There's a little section about that. Because God's making it clear, I may start with my own house judging them, but I'm going to judge all the nations who dishonor me. But then, in the latter part of Ezekiel's ministry, chapter 33 all the way to the end of the book, it's a future time of restoration. So in other words, the book of Ezekiel kind of divides itself up into three parts. The first part, judgment's coming upon God's people. Jerusalem will be destroyed. Second part, foreign nations are going to be judged. Third part, there is going to be a future time of restoration. And that's just the overall picture. And if you'll keep that in mind as you then read, those are the historical events. That's the setting you need to understand to make everything start to make sense. Okay, question or comment about that? Now, Marty, I still don't understand about that weird opening vision in the first three chapters. That's right. And why don't we understand that? Because we don't understand the ancient culture. Remember, that was the third thing. Okay? The culture. We've got to understand that. But at least right now, we've got the historical background to understand all that. All right, Ralph?
How long did you say Assyria was in?
They were the major world power for over two centuries. Oh, yeah,
you know,
right.
We think we're this big nation. We've been in power for 200 years plus.
Yeah, we are a nation that, you know, we have been in existence. In fact, it's kind of interesting. If we were ancient Assyria, okay, it's right about now in our history, when we're going downhill, we're fixing to decline. Well, that's kind of scary when you start thinking about that comparison. Yeah, that's really true. And, you know, Isaiah had always said, you know, there's a remnant of people who were trying to do what's right and who would be trying to do what was right. And, of course, Ezekiel sort of exemplifies what you're saying, because here's Ezekiel. He's taken away. He's a young man taken away into exile. In fact, that 30th year point, Tommy, anyone know the significance of a 30th year of a Israelite's life? If you were of the tribe of Levi, the line of Aaron, if you were a priest, when did you start to serve as priest in Yahweh's temple? When you were 30 years of age. So, I mean, there's something poignant and tragic. I mean, Ezekiel, and I don't guess I've said this, but if you've read the book, you've noted this, Ezekiel was in the priestly lineage. His father was a priest. And so here is Ezekiel. He's a priest ready to serve at the temple of Yahweh. And yet, where is he? He's not in Jerusalem. He's in Babylonia, of all places, enduring punishment with his sinful people. And what we'll find so interesting as we go through the oracles and the visions that God gives him, several of his visions, God has him in a visionary state be transported to Jerusalem and to see what's going on in the temple. If he were serving as a priest, what would he be seeing there? All this idolatry and immorality and decadence. So that's the poignance of all that. And it really is just, I mean, if you appreciate all that, Ezekiel isn't just a name. He becomes somebody you really can relate to and you feel for. Okay?
Just thinking about the method. How long were they actually dragged away into exile? Where was it?
Well, actually, let's see. I don't have that map handy, but actually the area where Ezekiel and the majority of the exiles were. It's in the southern portion of Babylonia, southeast of the city of Babylon. We'll talk about that next time, along the Kabar River.